Good morning, everyone. Hope you're not feeling too fragile. I had an early night last night, so I'm on my game. This morning's plenary session is sponsored by Towers Watson. As somebody just said eloquently in the front row, who the hell's Towers Watson? A lot of you remember Towers Perrin and Watson White. Well, they merged earlier this year to form Towers Watson. They're a substantial business, 200-plus employees. They assist their clients in superannuation, risk management, investment and employee surveys. So I'd like to thank Towers Watson for sponsoring this session. Thank you. Okay, this morning we've got, before I introduce our plenary speaker, we've got this plenary session, then there's a couple of concurrent sessions, then we go into lunch with Nick Sherry. The story there will be that we've got to get our lunch. Well, I'll explain it after this session. But basically, we've got to get our lunch quickly and then sit down. And then when he's speaking, we're not allowed to walk around. That's the bottom line. But anyway, I'll talk to you about that in more detail when we get there. After his lunch, we've got two more current sessions happening, about six choices in each. And then we've got a plenary session this afternoon on regulatory issues. Now, that sounds boring, I know, but it's actually going to be quite exciting the way we've picked the panel. We've got John Trowbridge, who's the APRA member, speaking to us for about 20 to 25 minutes. And then we've got a panel of Tony Coleman, Mike Barker and Mark Baxter, sort of three towering actuaries. I'm sort of there just to look after the intellectuals. And we'll be talking for about 25 to 30 minutes about issues on global regulation and local regulation. So that'll be, so definitely hang around for that. Please do your evaluation forms as we go. We've tried a few different things this time, the way we've organised our plenary sessions with three short speeches and yesterday. So it'd be interesting to get your feedback on how you thought that went for planning for the next one. And also keep the SMSs coming in. That seems to be working quite well on question cards, so that'd be good. Okay, I'll introduce Hazel now. Hazel's going to talk to us about an international perspective on how Australia sort of sits within the world. Hazel's responsible for the... Hazel's head of funds management at QIC, but she's only been there... she hasn't been there that long. Previous to that, she joined there in January 2010. Prior to that, she spent 8 years with the Principal Group Investors in a variety of roles, mainly in New York and then as PGI's Asia ex-Japan business head based in Singapore. So she's got a lot of external experience and sort of being able to look into Australia. She was prior to that with Towers Perrin, which is purely coincidental for the sponsorship here today, but a bit of a laugh, really. would you please welcome Hazel McNeely to talk to us about Australia from an international perspective. Thank you, Hazel.
Thank you, and good morning, everybody. It's great to be here and to see a number of familiar faces here, as well as a number of other people that I look forward to getting to know now that I'm back in Australia. As Barry indicated, I've been out of Australia for the last round about 7 years. And so Meredith asked me whether I would like to provide some kind of a perspective on Australia and some thoughts, some lessons learned, if you like, from the time that I have spent in a number of other countries. So that's what I'm going to try and do today. So I'm going to start off by a few comments coming back to Australia, what strikes me, what's changed in the 7 years I've not been here, and what are some of the things that I see that have not changed. And then I'm going to move on. And since I was away for 7 years, I've come up with seven lessons, if you like, that I've learned from some of my international travels that I'd like to share with you, and then provide some concluding remarks, which hopefully bring out some of the relevance of some of these lessons learned to the Australian marketplace. Just as a little bit of perspective in terms of what I'm going to say, the countries that are coloured on the global map here are the ones that that I've had a lot of involvement in that 7 years. As Barry said, for part of that time, I was based in Singapore, but was heading an Asian operation, which included some joint ventures in India, Malaysia, and China, and an operation in Hong Kong. While I was in New York, I had some responsibility also for some investment teams across Latin America, Brazil, Chile, and Mexico. So quite an interesting combination of countries, and also quite an interesting combination of roles. During the 7 years, I spent part of my time focused on distribution, so sales, marketing, client service, product development, those kind of things, and I spent part of my time overseeing investment, local investment teams in the emerging markets countries on the map. So my perspective is primarily from an institutional asset management perspective, but I would also add that some of the operations that I was associated with, particularly some of the joint ventures in India, were really more retail operations. Okay, so returning to Australia after 7 years, what has struck me? Well, the first thing that really definitely has struck me has been the kind of the barbell that we seem that the superannuation industry seems to have turned into. And what do I mean by that? Well, at one end, we've had significant consolidation in superannuation funds. So a lot of the large corporate funds that I used to work with when I was at Towers Perrin no longer exist. They've been folded into master trusts or other platform products. So a lot smaller number of larger superannuation funds. But at the other extreme, and something that certainly has surprised me, the self-managed superannuation markets has grown a lot more rapidly and to a greater extent than certainly I would have expected. I've certainly seen, as I've come back to Australia, quite a change, and I would say overall it's an enhancement to the way that superannuation funds are governed. The trustee boards seem to have spent quite a lot of time thinking about what they should be doing in terms of decision making and what they should be delegating. There's been a significant increase in the expertise that I see amongst the internal staffs of the superannuation funds. Investment committees becoming much more influential and having as their membership people with significant financial services experience. All things that I see as positive in terms of investment decision making by superannuation funds. One of the things that this has caused and is causing is quite a significant change in the role of investment consultants. Historically, when I left Australia, the investment consultants often really had delegated decision making. The boards would significantly delegate investment strategy, etc., to consultants. Now, I think we are seeing investment consultants being used in a way that perhaps would be more similar to how consultants in other areas are used, more on an advisory basis as opposed to on a delegated decision basis. I've seen since I've come back a lot more focus on MERs, so the total costs of superannuation funds. I'll return to that in my concluding remarks. And also, given the tax status in Australia, a lot more focus on really managing portfolios on the basis of generating after-tax returns. What hasn't changed? In the 7 years? Well, the importance and growth profile of superannuation. Clearly, it is dominant in the Australian financial services sector and will continue to be so. The fact that when you look at Australian superannuation funds, they do tend to have, on a global scale, pretty well-diversified investment strategies. Better diversified, I would say, both on an asset class and a geographical perspective than funds in a lot of other countries. In the U.S., as an example, investing in real estate is still considered in the realm of alternatives. Investing in international and emerging markets is still considered by a number of large U.S. pension funds to be kind of really a bit out there in terms of the core type of investments that they would normally consider. Whereas in Australia, the diversity of strategy has always, in my view, been on a more sound basis, and that continues to be, I believe, a differentiator. We have high-caliber people in the industry here. I think that certainly stands out for me and continues to be a key strength for the Australian industry. And it is a competitive market. There's probably 80 to 100 Australian equities managers here. Just about all the major global managers have a presence here. This is definitely a vibrant and competitive investment management landscape. Now, what I'd like to do, as I said, alluded to before, is turn to some lessons that I've learned over the last 7 years. Now, I'm going to illustrate these lessons by reference to particular teams in particular countries where I have observed particular things. Of course, I need to say that we should not generalize, and just because I might refer to a particular team in a particular country that I did or did not feel did work particularly well, that should not be extrapolated. The first thing I want to talk about is what I learned from working, as I say, with investment teams across a pretty interesting range of countries about what it takes to be a successful investment manager. And what I'd first like to do is just give you three alternative scenarios in terms of investment teams. Number one. A well-resourced investment team with a portfolio managers, a separate team of analysts, a separate risk team, a quantitative team, all equipped with state-of-the-art systems, and in fact sitting somewhere in China. Second scenario. An investment team led by someone who is recognized in that particular country as having very, very significant investment expertise, who has handpicked his entire team, and who himself retains significant decision-making authority and exerts a fair amount of influence on the team that he controls. Third example, a team of six sitting in an office that in Australia you wouldn't put more than two people in. Virtually no systems. If you ask this team what the tracking error of their equities portfolio was, they wouldn't be able to tell you. This team actually sits in India. The second last team, by the way, sat in Chile. Which one of those do you think would deliver the best investment outcomes? Of course, I haven't told you the whole story, have I? But in fact, in this example, it was the third team. the team in India. Now, why was that? Because these six people sat together, I mean, literally on top of each other in this tiny space. They spent the whole day in a very constructive way arguing and debating. There was a lot of constructive challenge going on there. They really knew their market. They didn't care about tracking error, but they really had a very, very good understanding of the risks in what, in this case, was the Indian equity market. And they produced very good results. The first team I alluded to in China that had, you know, all the state-of-the-art systems, etc., in fact, there was absolutely no semblance of teamwork whatsoever. The portfolio manager worked completely independently from the set of analysts. The analysts didn't even know what was in the portfolio, and that was done deliberately. The quant team was separate again, and they provided ideas to the portfolio manager, kind of in competition with the analysts. And the risk team sat again walled off, providing post-trade compliance and risk management, but really no proactive input to the process. And it was a disaster. And would always, in my view, be not work on that kind of basis. The second team, the team in Chile, very good people. The fundamental flaw with that team was that the head of the team recruited people all just like himself. They all came from the same university, they all did the same degrees, and there was the most amazing amount of groupthink within that team. And again, that just didn't work. So teamwork, judgment, passion, and constructive challenge, in my view, are the keys to successful investment management. On to a slightly different theme. And this is pretty relevant, I think, for Australia, given that Australia does invest, Australian superannuation funds and other institutions do invest a lot of their assets on a global basis. Now, if you're appointing a global manager for equities or bonds or whatever it may be, it's pretty important to understand what makes or does not make a global manager successful. My observation is that managing assets on a truly global basis, and I'll come back to what I mean by that in a minute, is actually an awful lot harder and an awful lot more expensive than you might think. Now, managing assets on a truly global basis, what do I mean? Well, what I think is important is being able to capture local insights, be they from whatever market, but being able to do that on a consistent basis, so having teams in different parts of the world that are essentially looking for the same attributes, so following a common philosophy, and being able to exchange that information and synthesize that information in a very quick and seamless way. And that is really not easy. Probably, in my experience, almost the worst way to try to do that is to acquire a lot of separate firms in individual regions and try and stitch them together. You will end up with a combination of different investment philosophies, a combination of different systems, which will absolutely not allow that commonality of philosophy and smooth exchange of ideas. It's hard work. It needs to be done organically. You need to think very carefully about who you have on the ground in the different places, and you need to spend a lot of money on the technology to support it. But if you can get it right, I believe you have the basis for a global operation that can deliver sustained added value. Now, when I started working in each of these different markets, on the first visit, whether it be to India or Chile or Brazil or whatever, the local CIO would always welcome me very, very politely, but within about half an hour, he would say to me, "Well, Hazel, you know, it's great you're here. I had the responsibility to oversee these teams, by the way. It's great you're here, but you really need to understand that this market is different to all the other markets." And I would sit and smile and nod politely. Everybody said this. And in fact, it's completely untrue. And I proved it's untrue. At one point, we had in our Malaysian joint venture, the CIO departed unexpectedly, and we had a little bit of a gap while we looked to appoint someone else. And so there was a very experienced person, in fact, in our Indian team. I said to him, "Well, how about you go over to Malaysia for a period and fill in?" The Malaysians were all very skeptical. They said, "Oh, no. There's no way this guy can help us. I mean, he'd never done anything other than Indian." And I said, "Well, you know, just humor me here. Let's give this a go." And it worked fabulously. There are definitely nuances in markets. If you go to Latin America, yes, they do have some pretty unusual inflation-linked securities that you don't see in other places. Absolutely, there are nuances. But fundamentally, when you talk to investment teams, the challenges that they face in adding value every day are really very, very common. And that means then, of course, that there is a lot of opportunity for people to learn from each other. Now, historically, I think we in the developed world tended to think that the learning really pretty much went one way. I'm certainly sure a lot of U.S. asset management firms believe that. And they believe that, well, yes, we can teach the developing world how to do a number of things. And I think that is fundamentally flawed. There is a lot that certainly we can perhaps teach our colleagues in the developing world. There is at least as much that they can teach us. I think this is highly relevant for Australia, particularly given the role that it has, and I think a very positive role, as a key education centre, particularly for Asia. Saying no, in my view, is a vastly undervalued behaviour. Where I have seen things go fundamentally wrong is often because we should never have embarked on the particular venture in the first place. At a strategy level, I think it's really, really important to have a well-defined strategy that is firmly focused on what segment or segments of the market are you aiming to serve, that makes sure that you are in, you have a really strong understanding of what that segment is looking for in terms of investment management services or whatever it may be, and that you're very realistic then in terms of what of those things that segment is looking for, your organization reasonably has the capacity to deliver. And if you start straying from that, you end up with problems. My previous company spent a lot of time looking at maybe going into the retail market in Taiwan. And that was just quite frankly silly. Our products were not suited to the retail market in Taiwan. The firm was an institutional asset manager. It just didn't make sense. So having the discipline and the courage early on to say no to some of those things that may, of course, may superficially sound to be attractive, I think is a real strength. So saying no at the strategic level, saying no at the product level. There are lots of reasons that you can come up with to launch a particular product. But in my mind, the only one that stacks up is that this is a product that for which there is robust demand in the marketplace and for which the particular manager really does have a compelling competitive advantage to deliver. As soon as you start launching products for any other reasons, you're into all sorts of problems. An example of this, I remember once launching a product. Because there was an objective within the company to get a couple of the investment teams to work together. And so the thought was, well, wouldn't it be nice to launch a product that brought together the capabilities of several of these teams, in fact, across Latin America. But the problem was that the product wasn't something anybody actually wanted in the marketplace and therefore obviously didn't go anywhere. So saying no to that, being very disciplined, sticking to fundamentals is key. And of course at the individual investment level. I was in New York in the heady days of 2006 and 2007. And also in the collapse in 2008 and 2009. Some managers in New York were busy justifying buying large pieces of real estate at clearly amazingly inflated valuations that really weren't supportable. Managers were justifying putting very risky investments into what should have been conservative fixed income portfolios to try to juice the yield. Those things really had no investment rationale. Saying no, while difficult at the time in terms of investor perceptions, clearly was what should have happened. Product scale. Now, I think if you read McKinsey or most of the other management consultants, they will tell you that product scale is very important in terms of the profitability of fund managers. I think, though, it's also very, very important for clients as well. Being in a product that is too small has all sorts of problems associated with it. The MER tends to go up, particularly if the investments are illiquid. They tend to be horrible inequity issues that arise in terms of cash flows in and out of the product, etc. So I think it is in everybody's interest to avoid a situation of lots of small products. And it's a huge problem. The median size of UCITS products in Europe is 30 million euros. That's tiny. I think, how do we avoid this problem? Well, the first goes back to what I was talking about before. Don't launch products unless there's a real proper reason to do so. But then if products don't work, it's really important to be proactive to either merge them or close them down. One point I would make is that when I was global head of distribution at my previous company, we had, in fact, a UCITS series. We always found that we had to launch separate products for the Australian marketplace. I think, and that was for a variety of tax and other reasons. I think in the interests of product scale, we need to think very carefully about that, because it's not clear to me that that is necessarily an appropriate situation. Products designed to support benign neglect by participants should be encouraged. I have a pretty simple view on this. When people are young and their account balances are probably on average fairly small, they don't care at all about their superannuation. When they get near retirement and their balances are large, they probably care too much. Neither of those is actually a very good outcome. I believe that life cycle funds properly designed really have a very important place to play in the superannuation industry in Australia. In the US, I worked for a manager that was the fourth largest provider of such funds in that market. Now, clearly, those products have come under a fair amount of scrutiny and some negative press. One thing I would say is that I think some of the issues that certainly did happen with those products in terms of the very negative returns that some of the short-dated products developed were really because the providers got away from the core of what they were trying to provide. Peer group risk ended up being a problem, and you saw as equity markets went up as they did, of course, before the GFC, you saw a gradual creep of higher equity allocations in these products than had been in the original designs. So my learning is that these products definitely have an important place, but we have to make sure that we stay true to their design principles. And my final lesson. There's a lot of debate in Australia about the adequacy of the system, and I would say, well, looking around the world, I'm not sure anybody's got it right. There are a number of countries, obviously, where still very dependent on defined benefit systems that are clearly under a lot of pressure, and a lot of DC systems around the world are not likely to deliver adequate benefits for the majority of the population. One system that I think stacks up reasonably well is, in fact, Singapore. High contributions, very much a whole-of-life kind of approach, includes provision for medical expenses, which I think is clearly going to be an important aspect for Australia going forward, but absolutely not. Certainly has some other aspects of it in terms of particularly some of the ways the investments are organised, which are not ideal. So, a few concluding thoughts. Remind everybody not to underestimate the soft side of investment management and to be mindful of the risk of groupthink. I think groupthink is a risk here. As I came back to Australia, one of the things that did strike me is how there's a smallish group of people who are very influential in financial services here. They are a high-caliber group, but I do think we have a risk of some groupthink just because the industry here is not particularly large. The opportunity for us to learn a lot from our Asian neighbours and thinking more broadly across Asia, perhaps, rather than China, which tends to often be a big focus. The role of life cycle strategies, I see that as one of the key gaps, quite frankly, in the Australian superannuation system. And I do think, as I alluded to, it would be helpful if barriers to investment in non-locally domiciled products could be raised. coming back to some of the comments I made about the fact that operating really high class global investment management is probably a harder and more expensive thing than might be realized. I do think that value for money is more important than MER, and I'm a little concerned that perhaps the focus on MER in Australia has gone a little too far. And I guess the final point I would say is that the Australian system seems to be clearly in a lot of change at the moment, with more reviews happening of it than I can certainly at this point, after 4 months, keep track of. I do believe that there is a risk in this and in the complexity that this involves, that becomes detrimental to the core objective of adequacy. Thank you.
Thank you, Hazel. We've got time for a couple of questions. The government's got an objective of making Australia a financial services hub for Asia Pacific, and we actually had somebody here yesterday who'd just been announced as one of the people on the council to review that. What any observations on Australia? I mean, we've been around this circle a few times now.
Yes. Every country in Asia wants to be a financial services hub. Korea, Taiwan, China, Hong Kong, Singapore, you name it, everybody wants to be one. And clearly some of those are more realistic than others. This may not go down particularly well in this audience, but I do not believe that Australia really makes sense as a financial services hub for the region. The countries across Asia are all very different, you've always got to be careful in terms of any generalities. But the important thing for me is really information flow. And I don't believe that sitting in Australia, you get the information flow from an investment management perspective on Asia that you really need. I really believe that the hubs right now are Singapore and Hong Kong. Shanghai is probably will probably play a part in the future. I think that Australia certainly has a role to play, but I think we're fooling ourselves if we think we're going to become the hub location for Asia Pacific for financial services.
So what do you really think? You mentioned India before, actually, and we're very China-focused in Australia.
Yes.
Everything's about China. Have you got any observations about China versus India?
Oh, plenty. I think it's fascinating. There's a lot of focus on China. I do think that more focus is warranted on India for several reasons. One, and this would be something very familiar to the people here, India just has so much better demographics than China does. But beyond that, when you look at India, there clearly are a lot of challenges, infrastructure being pretty close to the top of that, although there is some progress being made there, and definitely being the world's largest democracy has its price. But if you talk to the CEOs and CFOs of large companies in India, which I certainly have had the opportunity to do, they are ultra impressive. They will stack up against the CEOs and CFOs of the best companies in the world. You talk to the same people in China, that is not the case. In India, if you are a really successful company, you've done it in spite of very poor infrastructure and in spite of the government, not because of any help whatsoever from it. Whereas probably in China, I would suggest the opposite is the case. So I think there's I think India has got a huge amount going for it, and that we should be paying a lot more attention to India than we probably do.
Default funds. Can we trust the industry to build us the default funds that we need? And I understand there was some Uni of Queensland research talking about increasing equities as you get older because of just the nature of the liabilities. I mean, you said that benign neglect is the way to go, which presumably means that somebody's got to build a product that's the default product, an opt-out product. Can we trust the industry to build those for us?
I think we can. And partly that comes back to something I alluded to before in terms of the competitive nature of the industry and the high caliber of people that we've got here. So I think there will be enough challenge and debate so that we can get to good outcomes. The thing that I would really stress is that we absolutely need to avoid getting into a situation of league tables for these default funds, so you end up in this with this ridiculous peer pressure, which certainly, in my mind, caused quite a lot of the problems that we saw in the US lifetime funds.
Right, and when you mean default funds, you mean lifestyle funds rather than just bland funds, right?
I do, absolutely.
Yeah. You mentioned about governance issues before. I think you talked about superannuation funds in the US, the big pension funds in the US. I mean, do you have any observations of, because Cooper's looking at that issue in Australia at the moment, as to whether the trustee system works and whether it's sort of robust. Do you have any observations from overseas in Australia as to how that system, how you've seen it evolve in other countries? Can we rely on, is it a trustworthy system?
Yeah, as I alluded to before, I think what we've got here stacks up really quite well, and certainly has improved in my view over the last 7 years. I think the important thing is that boards need to understand what decisions they should be making and what they should be delegating. And I've been quite encouraged as I've come back to Australia to see actually quite a lot of progress on that. So you've got the board really making the key strategic decisions and delegating to investment committees, which have certainly increased in prominence, and to well-resourced management teams, the right kind of levels of decision. So, I mean, a lot of boards now have completely dispensed with the idea of having beauty parades, as an example, for new managers, which I must admit I always thought was generally a fairly futile exercise. That kind of thing is delegated to the investment committee or management. And I think I've seen some quite positive developments there.
Okay. We have to call it quits there, I'm afraid. And I just want to thank Hazel and just let you know, I didn't mention this at the start, but Hazel was almost carried onto the plane last night. She had a stomach bug, and which laid her completely flat yesterday, and I think you brushed up fantastically today, so thanks very much. Thanks very much to Hazel for coming. Thank you.